The birth of a child is a grand occasion for celebration and for joy. It's a blank slate, waiting to have a whole wonderful life written upon it. And mom and dad are filled with the greatest of expectations. They imagine that the best of their lives will be only the beginning for their children, and that son or daughter will soar to heights that parents could never otherwise have reached. Rarely do parents imagine the worst. Think of evil that could someday take over a child's life. In those moments when a baby is brand new and held tightly, the worst things that could happen of sickness or of sin, of disease or depravity, can somehow, in one's imagination, be cared for, be cured. But then, there are too many parents whose dreams turn into nightmares and whose hopes turn into heartbreaks because of some disability or disease, because of some disorder or delinquency, or because of death. One day, there was a man in the crowd who had held his boy when he was young and had had the dreams that any father has for a son. But those dreams were being shattered, and his son was slipping from his grip. It is a story that is told in the biography of Jesus in Luke chapter 9. It begins in verse 37. In the Blue Pew Bible, it's on page 1610. It is a story that follows another story about Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, where his grand glory was revealed and is one of the brightest spots so far in the story of Jesus Christ. It is almost as if Luke is now sharply contrasting the dark and the bleak story of this father and his deeply troubled son. For it was the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. "I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." "Oh, unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them, so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. This is the story of a father's desperation. So desperate that one day he showed up in a crowd surrounding Jesus and shouted out for Jesus' attention. You know that that is not what someone first does. First, you go to the doctor. First, you get counsel from friends. First, you try to stay up all night and think of a solution to whatever you're dealing with. It is only as a last resort that you go and draw attention to yourself and shout out and reveal the embarrassment that previously was hidden. For this man that day, secrecy was abandoned because he needed help. He needed help, and Jesus was his final hope. He didn't know where else to go. Time was running out. This unnamed father quickly described his desperate situation. The problem was with his son, his only child. Oh, not to say that only children are more special than children that are born into homes with more than one, but it is to say that all of this father's hopes and dreams were wound up in this one boy. That he lived at a time in history when blessings were counted in the number of children that you had, which was to say that in his scheme of things, all of God's blessings were contained in this one child. And his son was afflicted by an evil spirit. For some reasons unexplained, a demon had taken over his son's life so that sin was in control and the father and the son were out of control. A demon, a real demon, with intellect and supernatural powers and horrors that he brought into this family's life. You know, there's something about being a father that makes you want to be able to solve every problem your child ever faces, especially when your children are young, although it never goes away in all of a lifetime. But you want to protect your child from what hurts and what harms. And he couldn't. He was powerless. This was something far beyond his ability. We don't talk today much about evil spirits or demons. We talk about angels. Angels are in. Demons are out. They are relegated to Halloween or to horror movies or to science fiction books. But when you read the Bible, demons are presented as being as real as angels. They're counterparts. The angels being good, the demons being evil. As for me, yes, I believe in demons. I believe that evil spirits are real, that the Bible presents reality not just for then, but for now as well. I believe that demons are invisible, that they have personality, intellect and emotion and will, that they have supernatural strength, that they are intent in doing us harm. No, I wouldn't categorize myself as among those who seem to find a demon around every corner and under every bush and attribute virtually everything that happens to demons, for that seems to me to relieve all of us of human responsibility for the things that we ourselves do wrong and the sin that we have in our own lives. But I readily admit that we are engaged in a spiritual warfare that is as real today as it was in the time of Jesus. And so I believe that this evil spirit was causing violent seizures in this child's life. The only description is not from Luke. We have other descriptions that come from the other biographers of Jesus, for Matthew and Mark tell the same story. And you put them together and you find that this child was convulsed, that he would foam at the mouth, that he became rigid, that he fell, often fell, sometimes into fires where he was severely burned and other times into the water where he almost drowned. So apparently this father was on call 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, trying to protect his son from all of these assaults and all of these dangers. The father described to Jesus that the condition was both chronic and progressive, saying it scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. And so when all else failed, the father went to Jesus. The difficulty was that the day that he went, Jesus was on a prayer retreat up on top of a mountain with three of his friends. And so the father, not quite ready to wait for Jesus to come back, thinking that time was running out, instead sought the help of the remaining 9 followers of Jesus. And they agreed to help. So they went through their ritual of exorcism, said the words and made the signs and all of the things that they were supposed to do, which on other occasions had worked. They prayed the prayers, but this time it made no difference. It was as if they weren't there. It was as if they had said nothing at all. It was obvious that here was a power that was far greater than anything that they had previously confronted. Maybe you know how they feel. Maybe you've had people come to you with their worst fears, their greatest problems, and asked you to help, asked you to pray, convinced that somehow you would have an influence with God that they did not have with God. I've had that happen many times, where someone has asked me for advice or asked me for counsel or asked me to pray, somehow thinking that I could make the difference that they have not previously been able to achieve. And I've done it. I've prayed for them. I've offered my best advice. I've done everything that I could, only to discover that it made no difference. It was as if I had not even been there. And I found it hard to explain, because there have been other occasions where that counsel seemed to work, or those same prayers seemed to get the results that we were after. But this time it didn't work. And it's kind of embarrassing, but it's also sad. Sad that someone thought that I could do something with God that apparently I am unable to do. You've been there. Maybe you've experienced the exact same thing. And so we understand understand what those disciples faced. And the father said, I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not. You know, there is a pointed and a practical lesson here for us. It is the lesson that in the worst of cases, probably in all cases, we should go first and directly to Jesus. That we don't have to go through his disciples, we don't have to go through a pastor or a priest or saints or Mary or anyone else, that we can go directly to Jesus. That he has a power that far exceeds the power of anyone else. Oh, of course that is not to say that we should not solicit the prayers and support of others. We are instructed in the Bible to do that, but never, never let that be at the expense of exercising our privilege of going directly to Jesus Christ with the needs that we face. Why is Jesus better? Jesus said that we are all too short on faith and all too full of sin to handle life's greatest conflicts with evil. In Jesus' words, he said, O unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? You see, there are those situations that only Jesus can deal with. That's why it's always best to point people to Jesus. For others are too weak, too sinful, too often fail, too helpless. And so we go to Jesus, who said to this father the marvelous words, bring your son here. Bring your son here. I think his heart must have just soared with joy and hope, only to have it come crashing back down again. For in a second or few, this evil spirit seized his son. Again, he couldn't have been more than a few yards away. The demon must have recognized who Jesus was and saw what Jesus was going to do. He knew that he was a goner and had only moments left. And so he grabbed hold of this child one more time and threw him to the ground in a convulsion. Luke uses the same word that the Greeks used in athletic events for a boxer that pummels an opponent until he is dropped to his knees and flattened on the ground, or in a wrestling match when a person is pinned by an opponent. This evil spirit smashed this child to the ground. There's a lesson in there for us. There's a lesson about evil. That evil always seeks to damage and to destroy. That evil always takes its last licks. That evil, when it knows that Jesus is triumphant, still seeks to cause every injury possible. For just as good hates evil, evil hates good. And we are in a spiritual battle. In the next moments, there came the clash of powers between good and evil, between Jesus and the demon, between heaven and hell. Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they're all amazed at the greatness of God. Here, wound into a single miracle, were three great changes, spiritual and physical and relational. Spiritually, Jesus rebuked the evil. He confronted and defeated this demon. It was a power struggle, and Jesus won. He kicked the demon out of this boy once and for all. Did that then mean that he was physically cured and would experience no more seizures? Apparently not. For Luke, himself a physician, made a distinction between spiritual healing and physical healing. He added, saying that Jesus rebuked the evil spirit and then healed the boy. What would have happened if Jesus had just met his needs spiritually? Would he have continued with his seizure disorder? Well, apparently he would. But Jesus did both. He met his needs spiritually and physically and relationally. For Jesus gave him back to his father. Whoa, you say, didn't you contend just a few moments ago that the father must have been with his child 24 hours a day? He was trying to protect him from the seizures that he had from the fire, from the water. They weren't apart. In fact, at that very moment, probably the father's hand was on his son's shoulder. But you know, you can live in the same house with somebody and not be connected. You can be with somebody 365 days of the year and 24 hours of every one of those days and be as distant as if you were a continent away. Physical proximity does not mean that the relationship is what it is supposed to be. And so, in some ways, the most wonderful part of the story is that Jesus gave the Son back to his Father, and they could have the kind of relationship that God meant for them to have. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. Frankly, this was so supernatural, was so spectacular, was so multifaceted that there was no other explanation but that God had done it. They were just amazed at the greatness of God. Over the last several months, almost every time I've had a telephone conversation with my mother, she has told me the story of a longtime friend of hers who has been losing his eyesight. She first told me that he was unable to read. A man who has been a Christian for many, many years and who daily read the Bible in significant measure and was grieving the loss of his ability to read the Word of God. And so I talked to my mother about getting audio tapes so that her friend could listen to the Bible even though he could not read it. And then it was in another conversation that she told me about the decision to take away his driving privileges. He couldn't see well enough to drive the car, and so his license had to be surrendered. In another conversation, she told me about getting multiple opinions from different ophthalmologists, but in every case, the diagnosis and the prognosis was the same. It was degenerative. There was nothing that could be done to halt the degeneration, certainly nothing that could be done to restore the eyesight that had already been lost. He would soon be completely blind. My mother and the man's wife and some other friends committed to pray for God's intervention. In my skepticism, I thought perhaps the prayers were too late. But it was about 2 weeks ago that in conversation with my mother on the telephone, she told me the amazing story that his sight quickly returned, amazingly returned. He's able to read just fine. He went back to the Division of Motor Vehicles, took his road test, took his written test, took the eye test. I don't think they face this very often. He got his driver's license. He's driving again. It's just fine. Apparently God healed him. How do you explain that? Those there involved would say that the only explanation is the same explanation that Luke reported concerning Jesus' encounter with this son and father. That they were all amazed at the greatness of God. There is no other explanation. God did it. Now, this lovely story ends with a short paragraph that seems mistakenly out of place, almost as if when Luke was writing this at the computer, he cut and pasted, and he fouled it up. It was sort of an editorial mistake. It was out of sequence. For it says that while everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." And they didn't understand what this meant. It was hidden from them. So that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. Well, Jesus said it, but they didn't get it. He said, "I'm going to be betrayed. I'm on my way to Jerusalem. I'm headed to the cross." That's the great spiritual battle. That's the great encounter of good against evil. We're going to deal with this not one person at a time, but I am going to take on all human sin and all human eternal dilemma and win once and for all. That is not to minimize the importance of this story. It is not to say that this father or child were unimportant. It is not in any way to hint that what happened there was not wonderful. But what Jesus was destined to and where he was going dwarfs what happened in this story. He was headed to the cross, and central to the story, central to the biography, central to the gospel, is not the individual crisis, it is the cross. For that is what the gospel is all about. They didn't understand that, at least not yet. It would take them some time, years, before they would grasp, before they would fully believe, before they would be truly Christians. There are some lessons, I think, that we learn from this story. We learn that there is no problem that you cannot bring to Jesus. We learn that Jesus can help when no one else can. We learn that evil never easily gives up. We learn that Jesus wants to intervene in our lives spiritually, physically, and relationally. And we learn that the main message is not our immediate crisis, although he cares deeply about our immediate crisis. But the main message is not our immediate crisis. It is the cross. Perhaps you say, you know, I want to believe all that. I want to believe that there are demons. I want to believe that Jesus can meet my deepest needs. I kind of believe, but you know, I don't really totally believe. Pieces maybe, but not the whole thing. In Mark's biography of Jesus, he tells us a piece of the conversation that Luke did not report. He says that the Father asked Jesus if it was possible for Jesus to help. And Jesus answered, "Everything is possible for him who believes." And immediately the Father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." If I read him right, he's saying, "Jesus, I believe. I really do. A little. But sure is a lot that I don't believe. Will you help me with the part where I don't believe? Will you take the little that I do believe and build on it and change my unbelief into faith? Hey, listen, I don't know what is your battle against evil. I don't know what is the problem that you face. I probably can't much help. I can point you to Jesus Christ. And I can tell you that when you go to him, he will ask you, "Do you really believe in me?" And if you're honest, you may have to say, "I believe a little. But I've still got a lot of unbelief that I struggle with." Then why not say to him, as this father said to him, "I do believe. Help me with the unbelief." Father, hear the prayer that we pray, the Father's prayer. As we bring all of our needs, our sins, our problems, our destiny to you, we want to believe. We do believe. Help to turn our unbelief into faith in Jesus.